This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast. Broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where we might live upon the earth, and certainly this program is important for all people. Today we're going to continue with my book, Jewish Supremacism, the 14th and final chapter of the book in our audio format. And ladies and gentlemen, as a preface to continuing this book, I want to discuss how people look at the problem of Jewish extremism. It's an amazing scenario, ladies and gentlemen, when if one simply criticizes Jewish extremism, Jewish supremacism, or Jewish racism, the elements of that in the Jewish community, or the actions of that nature in Israel, then that individual will be called a supremacist, or a racist, or intolerant, or, of course, an anti-Semite, an incredibly damaging term. It seems to me that the proper criticism should be leveled at the Jewish extremists themselves. And again, not all Jews are extremists, not all Jews are supremacists, not all Jews support the criminal and terrorist actions of the state of Israel. But we must talk about these realities because they are a factor in what's going on in the world today. The neocons who are dominating and controlling the American foreign policy are lurching this world toward a, quote, clash of civilizations, unquote. A terrible clash of values, a war of terrorism, of hate, of dislocation, of anger. And I think as a member of the world community, as an American citizen, and as a person of European descent, that I have a responsibility to try to prevent these neocons and these radical Jewish extremists from achieving their goal. And unfortunately, they have achieved their goal quite well over the last few years. They have immersed America into the Iraq War, which thankfully many Europeans opposed. It's been a war that's absolutely devastating to the interests of the American people. Not only have thousands and thousands of American boys and even women today been maimed and disfigured, crippled, blinded, emasculated, and killed in this war, and the great suffering that has come from it, of course, and to their families. We've also spent perhaps $1 trillion, even more than that, in terms of the treasury and the wealth of the United States of America, because the long-term cost of this war will certainly reach into the trillions of dollars. More importantly, perhaps even than that, we've launched this war against the country unjustly. There were no weapons of mass destruction, as I said from the beginning. And we've launched this war, and we've literally caused the deaths of at least 100,000 men, women, and children, civilians, primarily innocent people in that country, because this country has been thrown into chaos by the actions of the United States, under the helm, of course, under the control of the neocons, such as Richard Perle and David Wormser and Crystal and Paul Wolfowitz, who was, and these people, of course, were the biggest orchestrators of the war, and these individuals are Jewish partisans, Israeli partisans, who literally, for instance, Perle and Wormser literally wrote papers for the Israeli government calling for an attack upon Iraq, on Iran and Syria. And we've been following their scenario, and it's been very positive, I imagine, for the aims of the Jewish supremacists, racists in Israel, but it's certainly not been positive, I think, for the average Jewish person in Israel or around the world. It's certainly not been positive for the American people, It certainly hasn't been positive for the Iraqi people. And we need to start confronting these issues. It's okay, you see, to expose any sort of white supremacy, which I, by the way, I oppose. I believe in equal rights for all people. I believe all people have a right to preservation and freedom. And I don't believe any race should be supreme over another. I don't believe any country should be supreme over another. Every nation is an individual, sovereign society. I believe in a republic, not an empire. I don't think America should have 67 bases around the world and try to dictate to the world and the people of the world how to live their lives. I think we must have freedom, not only for the people around the world, but freedom for the American people. And if you look at history, if you look, for instance, at the history of the Roman Empire, when nations tried to establish these great empires over vast stretches of land and across cultures, what they end up doing is taking away their own freedom at home, and actually, ultimately, often, their own viability and their own well-being. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have a critical situation coming in the world today. And my book, Jewish Supremacism, is not opposed to all Jews, but it exposes the elements of radical Jewish extremism that exist among organized Jewry today, such as the main organizations in the United States, like the American Jewish Congress, American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, the radical actions of the State of Israel, which I believe very strongly to be the worst terrorist offender on earth. Today, the State of Israel, a nation that's jailed hundreds of thousands of people, tortured well over 150,000 people in their prisons, dispossessed literally hundreds of thousands of people from their homes, their businesses, their farms, terribly oppressed and occupy the West Bank and Gaza, committed terrible war crimes in Lebanon. And we can go on, ladies and gentlemen. And I oppose that. And again, for doing so, I will be called an extremist, or I will be called a hater. And the hatred is not part of what makes up a David Duke. You know, I love my traditions. I love my heritage. I want to preserve my heritage both in America and Europe and around the world. But I also respect other peoples. And I also respect the Jewish people. But I don't respect the actions of these extremist Jewish criminals, such as who run the State of Israel. Ariel Sharon may not be alive too much longer, but the man is a terrible war criminal. And no one wishes death or pain on any individual, but I also think that America should have opposed his murderous actions over the years. Now, this is the butcher of Sabra and Shatila. And I think America has a responsibility to try to prevent as much innocent the death of innocent life as possible, and yet we literally were complicit in the Israeli attack upon Lebanon, which resulted in the death or disfigurement or maiming of thousands of men, women, and children in that country, and the complete destruction of a nation. And by the way, it was a nation that was friendly to the United States of America, a nation that we helped, a government we helped install. A government that we helped remove the Syrian occupation forces, even though I think, by the way, that Syria is not a bad country. I think that the Syrian people are very decent people, and I think it would be tragic if we went to war against Syria, and I think that we should, there's no reason why we can't be friends with Syria. In fact, Syria was part of the coalition against the original Gulf War. And there's no reason why Syria can't be a friend, but we're literally, because of the Jewish neocon power and influence in the United States, we're pushing these countries into being our enemies. And that's not good for them, and it's certainly not good for the United States of America. Well, ladies and gentlemen, again, we're going to go ahead and go into the second part now of the 14th chapter. I think you're going to find it very interesting, and I'll be with you again as soon as we finish this part. The next section is entitled, Will Intermarriage End Jewish Supremacism? It is often said that the high rates of intermarriage between Jews and Gentiles, especially in the United States, will diminish ethnocentrism and cause assimilation of the Jewish population into the Gentiles' gene pool. Now, that contention is made in the highly publicized and promoted book, The Myth of the Jewish Race, by Ralph and Jennifer Patai. They suggest that Jewish intermarriage has steadily increased since the Enlightenment. It is true that many Jewish groups and leaders have raised a great commotion about the dangers of intermarriage. Major Jewish publications often have articles, even ads, decrying intermarriage and imploring Jews to marry only other Jews. Steve M. Cohen writes the following in The Jewish Family, Myths and Reality. Vigorous efforts by organized Jewry to try to halt or reverse recent demographic changes to get large number of Jews to change their family-related decisions, that is, to marry young, marry each other, stay married, and have many children, unquote. Pinchas Stolper writes of the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America promoting only strong, pure Jewish marriages. In describing the threat of a beautiful Gentile girl living just a few houses away, he asserts, and I quote, "Intermarriage is a tragedy the Jewish people cannot tolerate. The person who marries out of the faith has turned his or her back on the Jewish people. Our tradition regards such a person as spiritually dead, and the family sits Shiva, observes a period of mourning, for him or her. Such marriages rarely work, even when accompanied by a social or so-called conversion to Judaism, and certainly can never work when the Jewish partner is seriously concerned with his or her Jewishness. For the families involved, the result is heartbreak and tragedy, and for the children, a life of frustration, conflict, and strain." Unquote. David Landau shows that Jewish fundamentalism is rapidly increasing in the diaspora. He quotes one of the opponents of a mild change in reform law allowing tracing of genealogy through the father rather than the mother as, quote, "one of the most evil crimes, almost akin to Hitler. It destroyed the integrity of the Jewish people," unquote. Rising fundamentalism has also meant a rise in birth rates among the most committed Jews. In an essay in the book, The Jewish Family, Myths and Reality, Cohen notes that through high birth rates and by, quote, "using insulating mechanisms, the Hasidims have achieved a high degree of success in offsetting the assimilative tendencies of the larger society," unquote. Therefore, it can be seen that organized Jewry has made a concerted effort to encourage endogamy among Jews. Orthodox groups are certainly those most extremely opposed to intermarriage, but even the newspapers and magazines published by reform groups strongly discourage it. The Jewish researcher Ellman comments in the journal Jewish Social Studies that the only ethnic or religious community in the United States that continues to attempt to limit and discourage conversions and intermarriage is the organized Jewish community. But Ellman, along with a number of other authors who are strongly opposed to intermarriage, also believe that the seemingly high rates of intermarriage are no real threat to the Jewish heritage. He suggests that it strengthens the traditional Jewish culture and genotype by eliminating those Jews who have assimilationist tendencies. Ellman points out that intermarriage has little effect on the core of Judaism. He points out that intermarriage is far more frequent for second and subsequent marriages in which couples are unlikely to have children. He also notes the much higher rates of divorce in intermarriage. More than 90% of intermarriages results in non-conversion, and thus the intermarried do not become part of the Jewish community. Only a small percentage of children of intermarriage are raised as Jews, and more than 90% of them do not marry Jews. Ellman also reports that Jews of higher economic and socioeconomic status are more likely to marry other Jews, thus the community will continue to be dominated by a pure Jewish elite core, while lower class Jews who do not represent the desired traits of ethnic solidarity are much more likely to marry outside and leave the community. Barry Kosman and other Jewish researchers in highlights of the CJF 1990 National Jewish Population Survey found that 91% of intermarriages were made up of non-conversionary couples and that only 28% of the children of such couples were raised as Jews, and that even this small minority's descendants would not be likely to marry Jews. Not only are intermarried Jews far more prone to leave the Jewish circle, evidence suggests that they often encounter hostility in Jewish society. Jewish authors such as Michael Mayer and C. Waxman cite tacit rejection of the mixed couples. All these factors indicate that mixed marriages have little effect on the Jewish gene pool other than affecting the overall number of Jews. Higher rates of intermarriage will probably have the long-term effect of strengthening traditional Jewish genetic characteristics. Jewish elements prone to assimilation are being removed, while at the same time there's a resurgence in Jewish orthodoxy and a high birth rate among the most committed of the Jewish elements, such as the Hasidim. Additionally, religious Jews in Israel are almost all Orthodox, and there is almost no intermarriage in the world nexus of Jewry, the nation of Israel. Perhaps the best way to describe the Jewish community is how the distinguished Jewish writer Daniel Elazar does it in The Community and Polity, Organizational Dynamics in American Jewry. He proposes a model of concentric circles. The inner circle is a hard core of about 5 to 8% who lead what he calls fully Jewish lives. Next are 10 to 12% of Jews whom he calls participants. They are often employed in Jewish civil service, working tirelessly for Jewish causes. Third, he identifies 25 to 30% of Jews whom he calls contributors and consumers. These make regular contributions to Jewish causes and make use of the Jewish community for such things as weddings, bar mitzvahs, and funerals. Elazar calls his last group the peripherals and repudiators. They make no contributions to Jewish causes, but sometimes the inner circles pull them in to participation, or they're peeled off, leaving the Jewish core at the center and the whole of Jewry more committed than ever. Because of copious publicity of high rates of Jewish intermarriage, some Gentiles may come to believe that Jews are becoming less ethnocentric. But in reality, the opposite is true. Those Jews left at the core are even less disposed to assimilate. At the same time, the outmarrying Jews who are amenable to Gentile values also serve as an important role in causing Gentiles to believe that the Jewish group is more similar to them than it actually is. More importantly, some Jewish researchers see a degree of intermarriage as having a functional value in Gentile environments. Mark Zaborowski and Elizabeth Herzog say that it serves as a bridge to the Gentile community, but one that does not threaten the Jewish core. Quote, "The peripheral area, which serves as a bridge to the surrounding cultures, fills several functions. It is an avenue to invasion, a buffer, and a source of renewed vigor. Each impact that chips at the outer edge may serve simultaneously to strengthen the core." Lieberman and Weinfeld, in their article Demographic Trends in Jewish Survival, view relatively high levels of intermarriage as a successful strategy in securing greater support from the Gentile community for their political and social goals, such as political support for Israel. And here's another fascinating quote, again, from Jewish writers. "The successful exercise of influence is best achieved in a community with a large subset of members interacting with politicians and opinion leaders. Through intermarried Jews themselves, and certainly through their social networks involving Jewish family and friends who may be closer to the core of the community, Jewish concerns, interests, and sensibilities can be articulated before a wider, more influential audience." In a recent interview, presidential aide Robert Lipschutz traced the origin of Jimmy Carter's concern for Israel to his close relationship with a first cousin, an Orthodox Jew. Carter's aunt married a Jewish man, and their two children were raised as Jews. Intermarrying Jews, while perhaps diluting the community in one sense, perform compensating strategic functions in another. Obviously, if intermarried Jews serve as a bridge to the Gentile community, those who are outside of the Jewish community but are conscious of Jewish blood will often have warm feelings toward that heritage and be well disposed to Jewish interests. They also express less solidarity with European issues and interests. Far from solving the Jewish-Gentile conflict, intermarriage only tends to reinforce the core Jewish genotype and nurture more extreme political and cultural solidarity. By sending their allies into our culture and body politic, they are better able to secure Jewish interests. Among Gentiles now, the process of intermarriage has the opposite effect. Because they're absorbed almost wholly into our society, our own solidarity is weakened while giving the appearance that the Jewish community is less impenetrable and ethnocentric. There is no real threat to the Jewish genotype. If anything, it becomes more Jewish with each and every new generation. Once I learned that Jews had a different genetic heritage than Europeans and that this difference was intensifying rather than diminishing, I wanted to have a better understanding of the relationship between Jewish behavior and evolutionary strategy. As a side note, I'll mention the fact that if you listen to the last two quotes, they describe Jewish activity as, quote, an avenue of invasion. In other words, it sounds like a war. And the second quote said that we'll perform compensating strategic functions. Again, it sounds like they're at war with us, and I really believe today that that's how ultimately their intellectuals see it. And perhaps that's the way it really is. The next section is an historical summary. This book has shown that Jewish history from the earliest periods recorded in the Bible up to the present tribal jingoism of Israel has been a long story of supremacism and ethnocentrism. Jews learned to thrive as a distinct minority in overwhelmingly non-Jewish nations, and they learned to preserve both their cultural and genetic heritage in the face of often intense pressures toward conversion, assimilation from the host societies. To avoid the process of assimilation that swallowed every other people living as a minority in ancient nations, they nurtured an ideology of intense inward group loyalty and love, and outward pointing ethnocentrism and hatred. Through their sojourn as a powerful minority in Egypt early in their history, they created a strategy of survival and racial purity. Later, in a region composed of many distinct peoples, they refined their ethnocentric policy and created the mythology that this policy was decreed by God. It is a strategy that finds its purest expression in Judaism as expressed in the Talmud. This worldly religion that promises dominion and power for the Jewish people rather than personal reward of an afterlife to deserving individuals. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of the second part of the 14th chapter of my book, Jewish Supremacism, in our audio format. I hope you're enjoying it, and it is fascinating, isn't it, to expose these elements of Jewish extremism, Jewish supremacism that exist and that are not talked about in the media. Well, the reason, of course, they're not talked about in the media is because of the fact that many of these Jewish extremists have incredible power and influence over the media. It's like, duh, that's the way it is. And I think once you open your eyes, you will see what's really occurring with these kinds of policies. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I really enjoyed being with you today. I look forward to being with you tomorrow. And don't forget, please, that your work and your support makes possible my work. It makes possible this radio broadcast, this free audio book that we've been broadcasting over the last couple of months, and my work in helping to wake up our people around the world and all the people around the world to the dangers of Jewish supremacism and extremism and its stepchild, globalism, and this incredible clash of civilizations that's being orchestrated and burgeoned around the world. It's a scenario of death and destruction for many people around the world, and we must raise our voices for peace and for decency and fairness and independence for all peoples. And that's what I stand for here, and I hope that all of you will stand up for those values, no matter of what religion or race or heritage you are. I'm a European, and I'm proud of my heritage. I want to preserve my heritage, but I certainly also believe that all people have that same right, and I'm no colonialist. I'm certainly not an individual that supports the idea that America should rule the world. I want to see America be true to the principles of our founding fathers. And it's not empire that we should desire as Americans. It's our own individual freedom. It's our own individual republic. It's our own individual rights and liberties that we cherish so much. We suffered 9/11 because of the fact that these anti-Americans truly have controlled our foreign policy and involved us into other people's wars around the world, and specifically in supporting the criminal actions of Israel. It's caused tremendous hatred against America, and we've paid a price for that, a terrible price. And obviously anyone who attacks America or causes the kind of death and destruction that was caused at 9/11 should be punished to the full extent of the law. And I'm for the United States government to hunt down and to mete out justice to those individuals. At the same time, we've got to recognize where this is coming from. And we have to look at the sources of so-called terrorism. And ladies and gentlemen, there's many kinds of terroristic acts that are coming from Israel, and that acts that we've complicitly supported by supporting the criminal actions of Israel. Thanks so much for being with me. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow for the next part of the last chapter of Jewish Supremacism in audio format. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddu.com.